Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. Decisions around COVID policy have been dominated by medical professionals and epidemiologists. They have been on the news almost every single night since March 2020, and their expert opinion has been the driving force behind COVID policy. But as we come to our second Christmas under COVID measures, have the medical experts and politicians got it right? And should they be formulating COVID policy with economics in mind to achieve better outcomes? I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Paul Ormerod. He is a member of the Advisory Council at the Institute of Economic Affairs and a Fellow of the British Academy for Social Sciences. Paul is also a visiting professor in the Department of Computer Science at University College London. Thank you for joining me, Paul.
Paul, you wrote your IA paper, Turning a Blind Eye, Have Economists Been Ignored During the Pandemic, a year ago in December 2020. What motivated you to write the paper, and what did you wish to change about the way we think about public policy in general?
Well, I think the reason I wrote the paper was that the COVID pandemic was being looked at from a public policy perspective with a very, very narrow and blinkered focus. It was completely dominated by the health professionals and by the various epidemiological models. Now, they have a role to play, but their sole interest is in health. And they don't have, it's not their responsibility to think about the wider issues, such as the costs of any lockdown or the costs of furlough, about how they're going to be paid for. So I felt that policy, a very blinkered view, a necessary one, but blinkered, it's only part of it, had really captured the government. And I wanted to say, we need to change this. We need to take a broader perspective and take more things into account.
And do you think in general public policy, when it comes to public policy, that economics is sometimes a secondary consideration?
Well, obviously, you know, politicians, like everybody else, you know, they're motivated to a considerable extent by self-interest, and so they may occasionally trump economics. But what I found particularly frustrating was that actually most public policy is looked at through the lens of economics. You know, the Treasury and finance ministers around the world, central banks, regulatory authorities, you know, all have many economists and policies filtered through this. And the key thing that economists understand is that there are trade-offs, that every single policy proposal that's put forward will have some costs and it will have some benefits. And that's what economics does. It doesn't always get it right, but that's how economists think. You know, we think of costs and benefits and the trade-offs between things, rather than just simply saying, oh, these are the costs, we must eliminate them completely. And that was the problem of policy. But in general, I say economics is very important in public policy. And separately, I think for the IEA and for other outlets, I've been very critical of the economics profession for, if you like, standing back from this absolutely critical aspect of public policy of the last couple of years and not doing the sort of thing which they normally do, which is to remind people, as I say, that there are costs and benefits and there are trade-offs between them.
The main theme of your paper was that governments have failed to appreciate the importance of economic incentives throughout the pandemic. You focus on microeconomics and behavioural economics, suggesting that had the government formulated policy with these principles in mind, COVID policy would have been a lot more effective. Can you explain what the difference is between micro and macroeconomics for the benefit of our listeners, and also explain in which ways policymaking using microeconomics could have better informed our response to COVID?
Yeah, well, microeconomics is essentially, is that part of economics which focuses on individuals, you know, how individuals behave, How they take decisions, how they respond to incentives. And macro, which means big, macroeconomics is about the big aggregates like GDP or unemployment, inflation, interest rates. And that's for the general public, that's how they really perceive economics, because that's in the news, that's in the newspapers, on the television, people talk about the Bank of England's decision on interest rates, people talk about what's happened to unemployment, and they see economics as being macroeconomics. Now, it is an important part of it, but economics in practice, whether it's academic or with practitioners in public or private sphere, is much more about microeconomics, about how individuals behave. And I think there are two main ways in which involving economics and involving these principles would have been effective. And the general point is that the great insight of economics, of microeconomics, is that people react to changes in incentives. It doesn't necessarily mean that they act, you know, completely rationally all the time, but if the incentive which face them change, it doesn't have to be a monetary incentive. If they change, their behavior will change. And this is a very powerful insight of economics. And so we could think of it in particular on going back to the test and trace policy, which of course was a complete disaster for a whole variety of reasons. And the government gradually began to understand one of them was that the low paid people who were asked to self-isolate, for many people with low paid jobs, they have to be physically present to get paid. Now they can't work from home on their laptops, or like some senior civil servants do, take time off to go on their Pelotons in between meetings. They can't do that. They have to be physically present. And so they didn't, they had an incentive not to register, not to be pinged, because otherwise they'd lose money. And the government didn't, it gradually began to perceive this, but it didn't really understand that from the outset. They needed a much more incentive to be persuaded to stay at home and to be persuaded to self-isolate. And I think the government did make a mistake. This is not this year, but going back to the summer of 2020, when restrictions were gradually lifted in June and July of that year, they didn't emphasize sufficiently that the pandemic wasn't over, that the virus hadn't disappeared, and that people did need to still modify their behavior and not mix as much as they did before the pandemic, otherwise it would reappear. And that message wasn't made clear enough. And so obviously then in the autumn of that year, we started to see other waves of the virus appearing. Now we can contrast that with, say, this year when the restrictions were lifted, people had learned from themselves. And even before the Omicron variant appeared, and people had reacted to incentives, and social mixing, social interaction was nowhere near as strong as it had been before the pandemic. People had understood the incentives, that social mixing increased the chances of catching the virus, and they'd modified their behavior. I think just a final point on this. We saw from the debate in Parliament yesterday the last couple of days on the 13th and 14th of December about the new Plan B restrictions, that there was a lot of scepticism and even anger expressed about the various projections and forecasts that have been made by the epidemiologists, which have been really quite shockingly bad. They've been consistently grossly pessimistic, as they were, for example, in the summer of this year, when restrictions were lifted, that Sage and various other so-called experts said, you know, there would be many, many more cases and hospitalizations than there actually were. And they didn't, their models are rather flat mechanical. These are epidemiologists. They just do, although it's at a reasonably high level, but for anybody with a reasonable familiarity with maths, what is really rather low grade applied mathematics. But they are looking, I say, from a mechanistic point of view. They're not trying to build in behavioral change, which is what, you know, economists and other behavioral scientists know about. It doesn't mean we always get it right, but these forecasts should have been modified. There should have been a wider range of disciplines involved with them, rather than simply churning them out from a narrow perspective, and the government would have been much better informed. So there's a whole range of areas where incentives and how people modify their behavior could have been used to make policy more effective. It doesn't mean it would have been perfect, of course, but I'm sure it would have been better than it actually was.
Well, one incentive that you spoke about in the paper was, you know, to help maximize the uptake of vaccines, was to pay people to get vaccinated. I mean, I think the figure you said was, you know, even if you paid everyone £25 to take a vaccine, it was a drop in the ocean compared to what was spent on COVID-19 measures. Can you maybe explain a bit more about that? I think a lot of people will be skeptical about that. But I also, I mean, is there a moral hazard in some incentives, especially when it comes to health policy?
Oh, yeah, obviously. You have to be careful with health policy. But the point here is that, you know, if you're vaccinated, you're vaccinated. And there's only, you know, well, at the moment, you can have three. And that's it. You know, you can't keep coming back for more. And so there is a cap, and it's in the records for an individual. And it wouldn't really be worth, I mean, you couldn't, if you said, okay, we'll give you, let's say, I'm just making this up as a fantasy number, you know, £10,000 to get a vaccination, then people would have an incentive to, many people have an incentive to go out and get COVID. So you'd have to keep it at a level where it's a reasonable number. It's a reasonable amount, but doesn't create that problem. And we have to remember that, you know, for many people, especially the low paid, you know, 20 or 25 pounds in the hand, you know, makes a big difference. Many people don't have savings. They don't have cash to fall back on. And it would give, in my view, it would still be relevant. There's been a persistent problem, as we know, with people who, for a whole variety of reasons, won't get vaccinated. And it wouldn't have solved the problem, because there are all sorts of ideas floating around about, you know, the conspiracy theories and so forth. But we just need, it's clear we needed more and more people to get it. And so a small monetary incentive, in my view, would have increased uptake of the vaccine, and we'd be in a stronger position now. So I think that was just the idea. And I think a number of countries have experimented, you know, with monetary incentives. So they're not going to be get everybody vaccinated, but it's certainly an incentive. And also, I mean, people, you know, could always have refused them. They didn't have to accept them. In the same way, say, there are campaigns to say, if you're wealthy, you shouldn't be accepting this 100 or £200 that pensioners get for winter fuel allowance. You can always decline it. And so people could have declined it. So the cost would have been containable, but I say it would have increased, in my view, the uptake of the vaccine.
One of the interesting parts of the paper, I thought, and it's very relevant today, I mean, this winter is not much difference really between December 2020 and December 21, is that you argued that the government relied too heavily on opinion polls when making decisions on lockdown. And these opinion polls consistently showed, you know, strong support for restrictions. How would public policy, which used the Economist's toolkit, you know, have gauged public mood at the time?
Well, economists, it's not that we completely dismiss polls and, if you like, what we call stated preferences. You ask a question and you state what your preference is between alternatives, or you state your view. And that's not the same thing as actually doing something. We place much more weight on people's actions, because what the phrase we use is that reveals people's preferences. You know, so for example, you know, if you, this is a hypothetical example, of course, but if you answer that you prefer, let's say, Coca-Cola to Pepsi-Cola, but you always buy Pepsi-Cola, we might say, you know, your revealed preference is not the same as the one you put in a survey. That's a deliberately, you know, rather silly and extreme example. But we can see, although there's been a consistent majority in favor of restrictions throughout, in practice, there's been widespread evasion of the regulations, some in to a minor degree, some to a more obvious degree. But there'll be very few people, or relatively few people, who've obeyed absolutely to the letter every single part of the COVID regulations. There's been widespread evasion, and we look at that and say, well, actually, in their individual behavior, you know, many people are saying, well, they're not terribly keen on lockdowns, actually. Although when asked in an opinion poll, they would say, oh, yes, there should certainly be more lockdowns. Essentially, what people mean is, I suppose it's highlighted by the Prime Minister's current predicament, you know, lockdowns for other people, but not for me, thanks very much. You know,
that's his revealed preference there.
But also, I think it goes back to the question of incentives. And if I could slightly generalize that and think about the furlough scheme and the calls to bring it back. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't have been a scheme, because this was, you know, a severe unanticipated shock to the economy. And what you didn't want was, you know, millions of people unemployed. But if we think back to that first lockdown in the spring and early summer of 2020, it's absolutely glorious weather. And many people were getting 80% of their pay to stay at home. So for many people whose jobs, you know, maybe really rather boring and mundane, this was like paradise. It was like an extended holiday. And they didn't, the true costs of this weren't made clear to them. Now, I think 80% payment was too much. And there should have been, without, you know, putting people into financial difficulties, but say 60% would have concentrated minds a bit more. And I think if that had been the case, there would have been smaller majorities, or certainly fewer people would have been so keen on lockdown, especially at that time. If you were getting, you know, 80% of your pay to stay at home, well, yeah, of course you're going to say, I want more lockdown. You know, of course you are. Like, you've got every single incentive to do that. If you're saying you're getting 60%, you think, well, it's okay for a few weeks, but maybe I should be thinking, I'm not terribly keen on it now. And I think that's the point, that go back to the incentive. You know, they should have thought much more carefully about the level of support. And the current time, I think it would be wrong now to bring back the furlough scheme. We have to say to people, we have to learn, we can't keep shutting down the economy on the slightest scare. It's just fits and starts. And at some point, the government have to understand that if you're investing in the hospitality industry, get an incentive, if it can be arbitrarily closed down or damaged by government statement or diktat, why bother? It will drive up your incentive to invest will go. This is why a broader perspective of economics and every single aspect of this policy, looking at it from this incentive point of view, I think would have produced better policies all round.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And I think one other thing that you spoke about in your paper was cost-benefit analysis. Now, I think that's pretty straightforward for anyone listening. You know, do the costs outweigh the benefits? And I'm just going to put it very simply. Do you think that the cost of lockdown exceeded the benefits in 2020?
Well, there were a few. I've criticised the economics profession for not getting involved in the policy debate. But in the early summer of 2020, there were a few courageous and distinguished economists who produced the sort of cost-benefit analysis that economists carry out. Say, for example, David Miles at Imperial College, who was a former member of the Monetary Policy Committee, Bob Rawthorn, a former head of the economics department at Cambridge University, they did independently with others cost-benefit analyses, looking at the whole range of things. And so I think this is, I think one point here is that I know this caused a lot of problems with people, and they didn't like it psychologically. They reacted against the idea that you can put a price on a human life. And that, if you like, was the benefit, number of lives saved from lockdown or whatever. But not just the National Health Service, but every health service in the world has to do this, because it has to decide how to allocate the resources. You know, which drugs will they buy? Which treatments will they prioritize? And they have to. I say it sounds rather macabre to a lot of people, but it's a necessary tool to try and value lives. And there's something called quality adjusted lives, which has become the standard in the health service, in the NHS, for doing this. So we can look at the benefits about lockdown in terms of the value of life saved or the quality of lives improved through the various policies. But the costs, as we're now seeing, I mean, every single day that goes by, what these economists wrote 18 months ago now about the huge cost, it's not just a loss of output and potential unemployment, but there's a huge increase in public debt, which will have to be paid for. We can see the tremendous loss, particularly amongst the less privileged school children. They've been falling behind in their educational attainments, and it'll be very hard for them to make that up. We can see rising mental health problems. We can see huge increases in waiting lists, and so people say with cancer not getting treatments. Or thinking in quality of life, you know, if you need, say, a hip replacement, it's not fatal, you can live with it, but people who really need it, that quality of life is very, very low. I mean, every movement is extremely painful, and they've been delayed. We can see child abuse, domestic abuse, all these costs, these vast costs, which the economists drew attention to 18 months ago. And it was clear that even then, that the costs of the policies the government were carrying out considerably exceeded the benefits. And so we simply have to learn to live with this virus. If I may say so, just to add to that, in the way in which the Swedes have done, the Swedes throughout have had the most minimal of restrictions, and they've essentially led normal lives, and the government have trusted the people to react to incentives and to avoid situations which put them at serious risk, and the Swedes have responded accordingly. And so it is actually contrary to what people might imagine. It's a highly urbanized society. Most people live, in fact, more Swedes live in towns and cities, than a bigger percentage than people in the UK, slightly more. And they've managed extremely well. Their death rates have been considerably less than those in the UK. And they've managed it extremely well by allowing people to form, by giving them information, and allow them to form views and incentives. But yes, but overall, I mean, the cost of these lockdowns, they are catastrophic. And every day, like I say, every day new evidence emerges of how large these costs are.
I mean, it's very interesting. And just to maybe ask a bit of a more economics-y question, how do economists measure value for like social costs? How do they put a sort of figure in a scientific way on social costs?
Well, like, I mean, there have to be, if you like, there are conventions. There's no absolute. Well, look, even all economic data, except sound on financial markets, you know, is essentially an estimate. So if we think about, say, national output, you know, even on the harder facts, if you like, we can't put the economy in a pair of scales and measure it. So there have to be indirect ways. So the Office for National Statistics gathers a huge amount of information and tries to process it in ways which will give a consistent story about what they think the level of output will be. And they'll use all sorts of data. They'll use, like, say, you know, tax records for pay-as-you-earn or all sorts of data. But there have to be various contentions. So how, for example, do you measure the productivity of civil servants? Now, I'm not being flippant here or facetious, but they don't operate in a market economy. They don't price their output. And so there are various conventions about how you might do that. And these have grown up over time. And so there's a certain amount of arbitrariness about it. But these are conventions that economists have thought about and over the years, and they seem justifiable. So, like I say, it's not a perfect science. It's not, we can't, you know, measure things in laboratory like physicists do. But economists do think about these things carefully and can, you know, justify the way in which they try and put valuations on things, which might seem, you know, it might seem rather difficult.
Although the paper we've been discussing was out last year, I think listeners will see great similarities to our current situation now. You know, we have another vaccine drive for booster jabs, and there's fear of more restrictions hanging in the air just right before Christmas. Paul, in the context of our current situation, what do you think the government ought to consider in the coming months to help these certain policies? And do you think that opinion polls are again misleading?
Yes, I think they are, because think about the incentives. There's no doubt there is a block of people who, you know, like if you're very elderly, you know, from your own, if you are acting in a completely rational and selfish way, then of course you'll vote for lockdown. And if I say if you think you're going to continue to get paid, even though you're working from home or not working at all, then, you know, there's an incentive to have lockdown. And I think it's this that needs to change, that this is clearly a new virus that's going to be around for a long time. Now, the scientific consensus amongst virologists, who are real scientists, because they actually look and see, they're not just doing in a rather trivial applied maths like the epidemiologists do. They actually know about viruses. And they say, in general, viruses evolve and they become more spreadable, but less dangerous. And the common cold is an obvious example, or flu. So we don't close the economy down for flu, even though in some years, most years, there are tens of thousands of deaths through that. So I think the government should be, its policy should really be to give information and to let people choose. That we've now lived nearly, you know, best part of 2 years through a pandemic, and people are capable. We should trust people to make up their own minds. You know, if you have some underlying health condition, a serious one, then of course it's not sensible for you to mix socially. And people can make their own decisions. I mean, I should say one thing that's very clear from the statistics, certainly in terms of deaths, is that at least 95% of all COVID-related deaths are from people who are either very old, in other words, 85 and older, or they are suffering from a serious comorbidity, like gross obesity or cancer or whatever. And the risk to otherwise healthy people, although the disease can be unpleasant, I had it myself about a year ago, I think it's not something you'd opt to get. But the risk to normal healthy people are actually very, very low. And that's, you know, the bulk of the population. And we have to let people choose themselves and work out the risk in exactly the same way that the Swedes have done. And they've come out of it rather well. So I think we should abandon these ideas of saying the government is bringing in restrictions and arbitrarily trying to dictate, or the whims of ministers and trying to indicate. And you're looking back to the lockdown in the first one in the spring and summer of 2020. It was really outrageous because the government had the legal powers to do certain things, but yet suggested as though the ministers were themselves making the law. There was a blurring between the actual law and, if you like, the instructions, if you like, which ministers convey. So, you know, people should be making up their own minds by now. They've got plenty of experience. People can learn. People are, in general, sensible. And I think that's the way forward.
Paul, thank you for joining me. That is Professor Paul Ormerod, but unfortunately that is all we've got time for.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.